Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we're talking about the HBO miniseries Show Me a Hero, starring several amazing actors and the high drama of public housing. Then, as we lean toward the late part of summer, we'll look back at some of the stuff we didn't get to talk about as much as we might have liked. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. The Ask Me Another podcast is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. And on the latest episode, Sir Patrick Stewart talks about living in Brooklyn and becoming a knight. Then he recites well-known song lyrics with the gravitas of a West End performance. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have local government and overdue appreciation on the show this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor for NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, due to the logistics of this particular week.
So weird.
It's just the three of us.
Yeah.
It's our little tiny mini family.
This is like Pop Culture Happy Hour Empty Nest Edition.
Uh-huh.
It's like Pop Culture Happy Hour Super Small Batch Edition.
Aww.
I just want everybody to know this is not a change to the format.
Nope.
This is not an experiment. It's just a thing that happened this particular week. We'll be back to our wonderful rotation of fourth chairs. So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Show Me a Hero. Show Me a Hero, the basics are these. It is an HBO miniseries airing in three doses of 2 hours each. And as we tape this, two of those three doses have aired, and the conclusion is coming this Sunday night, August 30th.
Opposite the VMAs.
Oh, good point. Good point. The sublime and the even more sublime novel.
Yes.
It's based on a 1999 book by a woman named Lisa Belkin that tells the true story of a local government, long-lasting, years-long crisis in Yonkers, New York. They've apparently been trying to get it on screen for many years because the events in it happened in kind of the late 80s. The series is written by Bill Zorzi and David Simon. David Simon, of course, made The Wire and Tremé for HBO previously, and Zorzi worked on The Wire and was a longtime journalist at the Baltimore Sun. And the director of the series is Paul Haggis, whom you might know from writing and directing Crash.
Yep.
Or being written about in various articles about Scientology, mm-hmm. which is his other newsworthy accomplishment of recent years. The heart of the story is a guy named Nick Wasisco, who's played by Oscar Isaac, who was a very young mayor of Yonkers who wound up in the middle of a very contentious battle to build public housing in the mostly white part of town in response to a court decision that mandated that they do that. So when you open the story, you kind of have Nick becoming mayor by promising to fight the housing order and then realizing once he is mayor that he can't fight the housing order.
Yeah.
So then you get into kind of the difficulty of being in local politics at a time when the people in this part of Yonkers were very, very resistant to having public housing built there. It's the wild drama of public housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at first, I was really afraid that that was going to be incredibly dry and boring.
Mm-hmm.
And when you combine that with David Simon's overall philosophy, which is like every David Simon show, you know, he did The Wire, he did Tremé, is like, the system doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's like discouragement, the show.
Yeah,
and
true.
This show follows in that pattern. You are getting a sense of why this particular system is not working. And in the case of this show, the immovable object, the thing that no one can get around, is the fact that, at least as portrayed on this show, and I think in events as well, the people who are resisting this housing order, the citizens of Yonkers, are a throng of monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
They're really portrayed as a throng of monsters. They're shouting in public hearings. They're protesting outside City Hall. And you have the unstoppable force of this court ruling and the fact that the town has a gun to its head. It has to abide by this ruling.
Yeah.
And yet you have all these politicians who've run on a promise they can't possibly keep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's telling people that they can avoid the inevitable.
I'm going to talk about the show ahistorically, which might be a little bit weird, but just purely dramatically,
mm-hmm.
the producers of the show are working under the assumption that its audience agrees with their outlook, that the people who are protesting the low-income housing in Yonkers, they call themselves the people of Yonkers, they're the white people of Yonkers,
right.
That those people are at best on the wrong side of history and at worst venal bigots.
Yes.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, very personally, safe assumption, okay? I agree with that. But anytime you as an artist are reinforcing the preconceived notions of your audience, you run a very palpable risk of flattening out the story. When you say hire an Alfred Molina, and he's like, so how odious do you want me to be?
And he's playing an anti-housing politician who mm-hmm. is a kind of an enemy of Wasisco's.
And he comes back, he asks how odious, and you come back and say, go full toad. Be an awful human
toad.
Being. Don't worry about any humanity. Just go for it. The danger is you edge into the area of, as much as I respect these guys, Aaron Sorkin and Jon Stewart, where the edge of polemic, the edge mm-hmm. of screed, even though I admire them, both Stewart and Sorkin have created this fantasy world where your political enemies are your political enemies because they haven't heard the right lecture yet.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they do, rhetoric will trump their deep-seated feelings and they will agree with you because you're right. That's dangerous. It also sets up in an audience member, or at least in me, a distance from these events. It doesn't implicate me. I think art should challenge you, mm-hmm. not reinforce your particular notions by drawing such broad caricatures. And I feel like I am comforted. I'm safe in my enlightened sensibility.
I think that's sort of fair.
And I wanted,
more than was the case in The Wire, for sure.
That cynicism of the show, anytime it is lightened by a bit of humanism, anytime that Catherine Keener and Oscar Isaac share the screen, mm-hmm.
right.
this show becomes so much more layered.
Yeah, Catherine Keener.
So much more nuanced.
Catherine Keener is playing an older woman who is a resident, a white resident of Yonkers, who at the beginning is very vociferously against the building of this housing for the same reasons as everybody else. Mm-hmm. She's convinced that, or she makes the same arguments as everybody else. She's convinced that it's going to be bad for property values, that she doesn't know what, quote unquote, these people will be like. One of the things that I wish they had gotten into more, and there's, you know, I've seen the whole thing.
You've seen all six.
I've seen all six because I had screeners. And one of the things that you will see as they go forward is they do kind of try to get into the difficulties in public housing that do, in fact, create problems, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's this character played by Peter Riegert with this fantastic beard who is basically a consultant on how to build public housing, who gives at one point in the series this great explanation of why you don't build huge high-rises, mm-hmm. you build townhouses. It gives people a sense of ownership. It avoids natural magnets for trouble like stairwells mm-hmm. that belong to no one,
right.
that are not anyone's property, that nobody feels any obligation to care for. I don't know how disputed or undisputed those theories are, but I do think a lot of people have come around to the idea that that kind of public housing can become problematic, you know, primarily not for the neighbors, primarily for the people who live there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wanted a little more of an understanding that it might have helped the neighbors to know, to understand that it was that they were talking about building houses that they hoped would not have all of the drawbacks of the kind of housing that already existed. Mm-hmm. But that's giving the neighbors a lot of credit for the fact that they were thinking about the actual problems of public housing and they were not venal bigots. So I think Catherine Keener is the one who is responsible for giving some humanity and some shape to those neighbors by saying she's worried, she's nervous, and the more she meets people and kind of comes to understand it, she begins to have a bit of an arc.
At the end of the second episode, where Catherine Keener calls the mayor's office, mm-hmm. and unexpectedly the mayor answers the phone. She's taken aback by that, and she explains to him, you know, her feelings, and then she says, well, you know, why won't you just say that you don't support this? And she hears in his voice a vulnerability, and that's why you hire Oscar Isaac. You want vulnerability,
uh-huh.
a neediness, a woundedness even, mm-hmm. and you can see it register in her face. And then he says, because I'm a leader. And you see in his face the fact that he's saying this out loud, and for the first time in his life, he believes it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that sets him on a path. That scene is so hugely important. Exactly as you said, Stephen, the premise is that the systems fail us. And what is the solution, or what is the reason why the systems fail us? He has said from the beginning, from Homicide, from The Wire, he said, it's because of human nature. Mm-hmm. People are greedy. People are, they want to hold on to power. They want to hold on to money. They want to take shortcuts. They want to do the easy thing. And that's why you need these moments of humanism, these moments of connection. She doesn't change her mind. It's just about getting beyond this very clear delineation that seems a little too pat.
Yeah, that's a really nice scene, in part because it's a subtle scene. Mm-hmm. I do want to give a little defense of the Alfred Molina performance. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely is going full toad, as you say, but it's a little unclear, at least in early episodes, exactly why. Whether he is coming at it from venal bigotry or simple political opportunism.
Right.
That he is really taking the opportunity, kind of as Nick Wasisco did in the first episode.
Right.
Nick Wasisco runs for mayor on the basis of, like, I'm going to fight this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep this from happening. And he knew full damn well he couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he ran.
Or he knew there was a very good chance he couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they were already in the process of losing court battles. And so, in a way, what you get is his nemesis coming up behind him.
There's a cycle.
There's a cycle, and that you can be swept into office in opposition to something you can't beat, that he then, as mayor, comes to have to represent. And I think, in a way, that Alfred Molina performance is really interesting because he's just, in a way, he's better at it than Nick Wasisco was coming up. And so, is he actually a venal bigot, or is he just showboating? There's a lot of showboating in that performance that leads me to believe that he doesn't necessarily feel it in his heart so much as it's theater.
I wouldn't say there's showboating for Wasisco, but one of the things that I think people sometimes find unsettling about politicians in real life, particularly when you get out of the highest profile people and into local government or state government or whatever. One thing that you encounter is not people who are ideologically driven by things that are massively different from what you believe, but that people who have a very limited connection to ideology at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can make an argument that Wasisco himself goes through a lot of this series without having any particular personal position on housing one way or the other. It's really hard to tell. Is he seeing an opportunity? I have an opportunity to do a good thing and be a leader. Or is he simply drawn to the idea of, I will be known as a leader. I will be important. Mm-hmm. There are clearly issues involving his dad and his feelings about feeling necessary and fully valuable and all that stuff. Does he really believe in the public housing that he's fighting for, or is he doing it because once he gets in there and he can't do anything else, he wants to win? And I think it's hard to tell.
Now we've talked a lot about the mayor, and we've talked about this white character.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of the portrayals of the people in the projects?
Yeah. It's a very disjointed show, and there's a lot of characters. And whenever we go back to the people, I'm thinking of specifically of the Carmen character, because of the way the plot moves forward, which is slowly, I keep wondering, what piece is this going to play?
Mm-hmm.
What is this storyline doing?
And these are stories about some of the people who live in the existing projects that we mentioned, where they may potentially be eligible to move into the public housing if it manages to be built.
And it seemed to me, particularly for the first two episodes, that the characters in the project were drawn a lot more thinly than the other characters. I do feel, as we ended the fourth episode, that things were coming into place. You feel the sense of inevitability. You feel this thing building, which is why, you know, I mean, the purpose of this slow build is so that when a scene like that scene between Mary and the mayor happens, if it happened in the first episode, it would be like, no, don't buy it. You need to kind of spend some time with these characters for those little tiny epiphanies to land.
Yeah, I'm not sure that those characters are necessarily always as well drawn as the kind of the white politicians, the Oscar Isaac character and some of the other ones. I think the actresses are doing the most they can with those parts. There's a woman named LaTanya Richardson Jackson who plays an older woman who is losing her sight.
She has diabetes.
She has diabetes, and she needs a special unit. There's a woman named Ilfinesh Hadera. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. I did try to find it, but it's who plays Carmen, who's the single mom, who's trying to figure out kind of how to get relocated with her kids. So I think they're doing what they can with those roles. I'm just not sure they're quite as fully built out as some of the other characters.
And I think especially early on, where it almost feels like at some point there was this discussion like, well, we can't just have this story about how white people sorted out this problem affecting black people and Hispanic people.
And in fairness to Zorzi and Simon, my understanding is although I have not read the book, my understanding is those stories of those folks in the projects are in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the conclusions I came to when I wrote about it for the blog is that I think, in a way, it's fitting that the people who are actually affected by the public housing feel less built out in terms of agency. Because I think one of the things they're saying in this series is they have very limited agency in this situation. They are left somewhat at the mercy in this particular part of their lives.
Yeah.
They are left somewhat at the mercy of these kind of angry clattering mob of white politicians and residents. And I do want to give a shout out to Haggis for the direction of the council meeting scenes with the angry crowd, where the sound design, they allow very loud crowd noise that you can barely hear even the principal actors, which is uncommon.
Yeah, those are very claustrophobic scenes that are powerful. I want to point out a couple of really nifty pieces of casting on this show. I think in general, this is a very well-cast show. I think Oscar Isaac, who I liked a lot in Inside Llewyn Davis, is terrific in this role. But I loved the casting of Winona Ryder as a councilwoman who is ousted very early in the show, but who comes back around and talks to Wasisco. I love seeing Winona Ryder again. I thought she was terrific. And Jim Belushi, who many, like hundreds of episodes of this show ago, I said was like, I think it was a Pop Culture Punching Bag episode, but somebody I was like, he is somebody who could have a very interesting late career life.
Yeah. And he's great in this,
and he is exactly doing that in this.
He's playing that guy. Yeah.
He is the mayor in the beginning of this show, and he's kind of a wheeler dealer, and he's so good. It's such a good role for Jim Belushi,
it
who
is.
I think has the capacity to have a bunch more interesting parts and a wonderful late career story.
Yeah. I'm not sure if he has tons and tons of range, but he's very good in this. Yeah. I think very good in this.
Simon does something to make us feel even more empathy toward the Oscar Isaac character. He shows him trying to build furniture and failing. He shows him trying to fix things around the house and failing. And that is a trope, because if you remember back on The Wire, McNulty tried to build a crib and couldn't do it. And I think there was a scene like
that in
Homicide.
There is a crib building scene.
It's like a thing. It's like a thing you do to say, yes, the world is overmatching this guy. And I am really fascinated to see what Star Wars The Force Awakens is going to be like, because Oscar Isaac is playing like a rebel pilot, right? And he's not going to bring the swagger of a Han Solo. He's not going to bring the opacity, let's say, of Luke Skywalker. Mm-hmm. He's going to bring this kind of wounded character, and that's going to be fascinating.
Sullen woundedness.
I'm tickled that he took this part.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we do, on the whole, recommend this show.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I'm sure if you have HBO, you can catch up in whatever way. They have everything available in lots and lots of different ways. As I said, the final 2 hours are coming this coming up Sunday as we tape this, and I hope that you guys will finish it off. It is really interesting, and it has an interesting close. And I'll want to talk to both of you about your feelings about how it ends. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit. You know, summer is beginning to go out of focus. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit about the stuff that we missed this summer that we'd like to talk about a little more than we have. We're also going to check in on some box office predictions and see how we did. Always badly. All right. So we'll be right back.
This episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message are made possible by MeUndies. 90% of your life is spent wearing underwear, so why would you spend it in anything other than a pair of MeUndies? MeUndies fit perfectly, keep you cool, and are made from Modal, which is 2 times softer than cotton. And now they're offering 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/pop. If you don't love them, your first pair is free. To show your support for Pop Culture Happy Hour, go to MeUndies.com/pop. And check out the goods.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we talked about one big summer show going on right now. And now, as we go sort of toward the end of summer, I want to start by doing our little box office prediction catch-up. Now, I still fall for the idea of doing predictions because they're always terrible. Mm-hmm. And I am famous for having one of the first things that I ever wrote for money that was not for Television Without Pity was a thing I wrote for TV Guide predicting the winner of the first season ever of Survivor All-Stars.
Yep.
And the one person that I said had no chance of winning was the person who won. Yep. I should not predict things.
No. Right.
I am terrible at predicting things. I lose our TV pool every year. Yeah. I'm terrible at predicting things.
That said.
All right.
Now to hear Linda's wrong prediction and how wrong it was.
I have some notes on what occurred when we talked about box office predictions, and we'll link to this episode on the blog. But when we talked about box office predictions, I have some notes here. Everyone thought
this was taken as obvious truth
that Avengers Age of Ultron would be number one. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it came in, not only did it come in second to Jurassic World, but it came in second to Jurassic World in domestic box office by like almost $200 million.
Okay.
We did not see the Jurassic World juggernaut.
I don't think we even mentioned Jurassic
World. Oh, no, we didn't. Okay. Petra was here with us on that day. And she mentioned it as her number two.
Oh, yeah.
So, Steven, yours was Minions, which actually not for a bad the summer pick. Is fourth.
Fourth.
For the summer.
That's not bad.
And Glenn, your pick was Inside Out, which is actually three for the summer. So you did really well. Mine is Mad Max Fury Road, which is way down the list.
But it was a hit. It was not. It wasn't like you picked, you know, Tomorrowland.
No, but...
And I think you said Tomorrowland might be a boondoggle, which it kind of sort of kind of was.
That's right. Oh, and okay, so I did better when it came to boondoggles. Mm-hmm. Boondoggles, I did pretty well.
Okay.
Here's my list of possible boondoggles. Now, one of them was Ant-Man. That's not a boondoggle.
Not a boondoggle.
It did fine. My other boondoggles were Tomorrowland, Fantastic Four, and Aloha.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
On the
so
nose.
I am 3 for 4 with major disappointments. I think we found my area of expertise. Glenn's possible boondoggles were Terminator Genesis. Not bad.
That's boondoggle.
It was middle.
It underperformed.
It was
It made more money overseas, though.
Yeah.
Well, right, exactly. So, and then Stevens. Stevens was Pan.
Yeah,
but it was delayed. Out, he cheated. Steven cheated. Petra's was also a Terminator Genesis, by the way. So I think what we can say is we missed the boat on Jurassic World by a little bit.
Just a little.
But we did reasonably. Oh, Glenn's other possible boondoggle was Man from U.N.C.L.E., which I think it's too early to tell. I mean, I think it's
kind of.
Is it did a flop?
Kind of tanked.
All right, kind of tanked. So Glenn did well on boondoggles too. We did pretty well picking out the ones that might super flop. The other thing we wanted to do is we wanted to talk about some of the stuff that we haven't gotten to this summer that we haven't talked about. You know, we do have a limited number of episodes and we do scatter to the four winds over the summer. So sometimes we don't get together to talk about stuff. Glenn, what do you have?
I'm not a horror guy. And I tell myself that's because I think the genre, despite its claims of being transgressive, actually has under at its core a very moralistic, normative quality that I find, you know, punishes otherness in a way that I just don't respond to. That's what I tell myself. In actuality, it's because I get very scared.
Me too, buddy.
I don't like the jump scares. I hate that. I don't understand why people enjoy that. And I also hate the linger scares, which is where you turn off the show and you're like, well, that was a pleasant trifle. And then I don't think about it at all. And then as soon as you have to turn off the light in the living room and go into the bedroom down that long hallway, it all comes back.
Yeah.
Hate that. That said, two films over the last few months have been so critically praised by people I respect that I checked them out on a bright Sunday morning.
Yeah.
With a big pot of coffee.
Far from bedtime.
Far from bedtime. And they were It Follows and The Babadook. Now, It Follows, I think it's better to go into that not knowing too much about it, so I'm not going to spoil it. I will say that, like all genre, all speculative fiction, it traffics in metaphor. You take the metaphor and you make it literal. That's how these things work. And the metaphor in It Follows is, you know, very clearly it's sexually transmitted disease. But in a more real sense, it's about the world of teenagers and how separate it is from the world of adults and how adults either choose not to see or can't see what's going on in that world. This film is so gorgeous. And it's trafficking in a lot of the tropes that things like Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street, this idea that suburbia, there's something dark lurking in suburbia, and suburbia is a very sinister place. But the cinematography is so gorgeous, and it reminded me a little bit of Let the Right One In, in that sense. And there is this feeling of danger, this feeling of dread that hits you from the very first frame, this implacable, relentless dread. It's a fascinating little film. I really dug it. Second one is The Babadook, which is an Australian film, very intelligent, very stylish, about a woman whose 7-year-old son is starting to manifest these fears and these violent tendencies, these beliefs in monsters. And this film's central metaphor that it clings to very rigorously in a way that I really admired is mental illness. It's very dark and gorgeously shot. And then about midway through, you think, okay, this film is going off the rails in the way that horror films, I think, often do, especially in the last third, where it's about, you know, the end, or is it? That thing, which is so cheap and schlocky. But this film is so creepy, and it nails the dismount in a way that cues very closely to its central metaphor of mental illness in a really smart, really satisfying way. And finally, really quick, Ex Machina, speaking of Oscar Isaac, is a very sleek little science fiction film, which has another kind of sense of dread, but it's a more vague dread, this kid, a programmer, gets picked to go to his boss's remote, very gorgeous mountain retreat, where he's built a robot. And the idea is that the kid will test this robot to see if it's actually AI. We'll give it the Turing test to see if it's actually an artificial intelligence. Oscar Isaac is playing this very bluff, weird, eccentric guy, also has that sort of wounded quality. And it's really weird. The score is amazing. And it's dealing with a lot of the same themes that Her dealt with last year. I describe it as it's Her if Her was less emo and if things happened. So that's...
I love that movie so much.
Glenn and Steven are going to argue about
Her. Ex Machina, a film that is better than Her.
Yeah, I need to file away a couple of these horror recommendations. I am currently in my house dealing with the fact that my 11-year-old daughter is suddenly obsessed with horror movies. She went away to spend some time with family this summer and came back like, Dad, I really want to see Sinister 2. And so if anybody out there has, I know we have horror movie fans. If people can recommend like horror movies that aren't completely inappropriate for 11-year-olds, that would be great.
I mean, scary movies, but not necessarily
like
gory.
She started out laughing at Goosebumps and like the terrible special effects in Goosebumps. And she kind of graduated up to like when she graduated from elementary school, she made like a mortarboard with like a bloody Pikachu on it with like fangs and like claw marks.
So this is vampire and monster stuff.
So she's definitely, she's going down that horror movie obsessive. Of course she picked something I knew nothing about. So recommendations from our people are very welcome. Looking back on the summer and things that I never got around to talking about, one is every summer in my world, there's at least a branch of the music writing and talking community about like, what is the song of the summer? Very often, you know, these debates, the debate kind of starts at the beginning of the summer, like maybe it's going to be this and maybe it's going to be this. And then over time it becomes apparent because there really only are five pop songs at any given time. Everything's on about a 30-minute rotation. And this summer, I managed to develop a sort of Stockholm syndrome with the song Shut Up and Dance by the band Walk the Moon. She took my arm.
And I like that song.
And yeah, and I have ultimately decided, okay, my trajectory with this song was, I love this song. I love this song less. I hate this song. I turned on that song like super hard. And then eventually, like I just finally gave up and just decided that I like it in part because I hate the song Cheerleader by Omi so much.
What do those things have to do with each other?
Like, there are only a few songs. And so, like, when...
You only have so much true hatred.
Like, like, if you turn on pop radio, you really only get... And part of it is, like, there's a song called Worth It and a song called Hey Mommy that are essentially the same song. So they have morphed together, so I'm always hearing them. So, like, the Walk the Moon song, Shut Up and Dance, is, like, a refreshing change of pace from these other songs that I'm less attracted to.
Real quick, you hate the Cheerleader song because of its lyrics, its message, what it says, or everything about it?
Everything about it. Especially, well, first of all, the message of the song Cheerleader by Omi is basically like, you praise me unconditionally, are always there when you are convenient for me, and never ask anything in return.
It's, like our, it's like our friendship.
And, that makes you super, and I'm going to sing it over and over and over and over again in one of those tiny little hook loops that make it impossible to get out of your head. So like, Viva, Shut Up and Dance, the song of the summer.
Yeah, it's funny that you would mention Song of the Summer because as listeners to our friendly podcast, Pop Rocket, know Guy Branum over there is obsessed with Song of the Summer as an ongoing thing. And I was thinking the other day about like why people care about Song of the Summer. I thought about this while I was chatting with a friend of mine the other day about what's the perfect pop song. And I realized I don't ask that question because I have a specific one that I want you to say or that I even care that much what your one song is. What I care about is you have to pick an actual pop song. It's the people that I ask that as like a disqualifying question for people who won't pick a pop song. You say perfect pop song and they're like Mozart or like you say perfect pop song and they're like I like to think of jazz as the ultimate pop or something like that where they won't engage the question. And it's the same thing with Song of the Summer. I don't care what your Song of the Summer is. I care that you're not like, you know, I always find summer to be the most melancholy of times of year, so I actually think this haunting No.
You think the entirety of Neutral Milk Hotels in the aeroplane over the sea.
Window down, song of the summer. Stop being obstreperous.
Like, but there's German also, leader.
Don't be an obstructionist. You know what I mean?
But there's also, there is a, like, in future movies about the summer of 2015,
right.
What song are you going to use to signify that we are in the summer of 2015? And
right.
That's one of the uses of, like, what ultimately boils down. And so, like, the summer of 2012 was the summer of Call Me Maybe.
Mm-hmm. That was one of the ones that was offered to me when I asked Perfect Pop Songs. So,
right, exactly. Know. And it's like, so when you want to make a movie about the summer of 2012,
right.
Like, the song is probably going to be Call Me Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's ultimately going to boil down to just a handful of songs, hopefully licensable by future
right.
movie concerns.
Right.
But, like, you know, we just talked about Show Me a Hero, and it's got not only a bunch of Bruce Springsteen songs, but Bruce Springsteen songs from 1987.
Right.
Like, you have Brilliant Disguise plays mm-hmm. at one point. They go back to a few different, like, hits of 1987 and 88.
A little on the nose. The use of Bruce Springsteen in Show Me a Hero, I find
agree.
A little on the nose. Side point. Anyway,
yeah,
go back.
But future projects that are right. trying to establish a sense of place
right.
are going to go to a song from the summer of 2015.
Right.
And it would be Bad Blood, no?
Yeah, but that, I mean, that's not even on Spotify. That's going to be an expensive song.
Yeah, it probably will be. All right. So, Stephen, songs of the summer. All right. I got a couple things. The Jim Gaffigan Show, which is on TV Land. If you are a fan of the stand-up comedy, particularly the cleaner stand-up comedy,
mm-hmm.
you may be familiar with Jim Gaffigan, who I remember my first Jim Gaffigan record came from a friend of the show, Joe Reed, who, when we lived in New York, I remember Joe giving me a copy of one of his CDs. And I remember riding the train and laughing. One of those times when you're like, I can't listen to this on the train because people think I'm weird.
Right.
His stand-up is great. I think it's widely recognized
yep.
to be some of the best out there right now. And he has this show on TV Land. So it's based on his actual life, in which it really is true that he lives with five kids, his wife and five kids, in a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. That is absolutely true. He has talked about that on NPR. We'll link to that conversation. And he's talked about that in his stand-up and books and stuff like that. So it's about this kind of ridiculous, to me, ridiculous arrangement that they have living with five kids in this, you know, relatively small apartment. But they love living in New York. They love being in Manhattan. This is what they decided to do. So it's about that. I don't love everything about it. There's a character played by Adam Goldberg as kind of a friend of his who, to me, is hitting a little bit of the old, like, throw guy in there who says a lot of kind of just mean, sexist things about mm-hmm. women. And it's he's clearly supposed to be a jerk. You're not supposed mm-hmm. to like him. But I got a little tired of that. But I think the central dynamic between Gaffigan and Ashley Williams is really nice and really well played. I don't know if I think this show is great, but I think it's good and it's fun to watch.
And it's just called The Jim Gaffigan Show?
The Jim Gaffigan Show.
Okay.
My other pick is Documentary Now.
Ah, yes.
Which is a series that recently started on IFC. It has been said by people besides me, and it is very true. It is the nichiest show you're ever going to see in your life because it is a parody of documentaries. The stars of it are Bill Hader and Fred Armisen. It is produced essentially by the two of them and Seth Meyers. And they don't just parody the general idea of documentaries. They parody specific documentarians and, in some cases, specific documentaries. The first official episode of the show is a parody, a half-hour parody of Grey Gardens, a Spinal Tap-esque parody of Grey Gardens, which is a really specific thing to want to make. It's really funny. I enjoyed it a lot. It's weird. I wouldn't want it to be longer than a half hour. I like the fact that it's not something they tried to do at feature length, but as a half hour thing. Then there's one where they are parodying essentially the documentaries that Vice makes with HBO.
Right.
They call them, instead of Vice, it's Drones with a Z. And the idea of it is that these two idiots are going to Mexico to try to report on the drug cartels. And no matter how often everybody tells them it's really dangerous, you're going to get killed. They just kind of go down there and blunder around. And I'm not suggesting that holds up as an actual critique of the Vice documentaries, but it's very funny. And then the third one is it's not even a send-up of Nanook of the North. It's a send-up of the documentary that revisited Nanook of the North and talked about how a lot of it was staged. But I really enjoy it. If you are a documentary person, the specificity with which they are capturing the tropes of documentary filmmaking, some of which have to do with style and some of which have to do, in the case of Grey Gardens, with specific scenes
right.
that they riff on. So Documentary Now is on IFC. They put the Vice episode, I think, out first online, but the Grey Gardens one aired first, is my understanding.
Yeah. I'll be honest. When I heard that these two straight dudes were tackling Grey Gardens, I was like, step off. That is ours.
Have you watched it?
I haven't. I'm curious.
It's funny.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. It's very interesting. So those are my two, Jim Gaffigan Show, which is on TV Land, and Documentary Now, which is on IFC. And when we come back, we will be at our favorite part of the week. What is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message comes from Blue Apron, the new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm fresh ingredients are perfectly portioned and come with an easy to follow recipe card, so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like Southern style shrimp and grits with zucchini, corn, and cherry tomatoes. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/pop to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/pop.
All right, welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time to talk about what's making us happy this week. Glenn Weldon, I'm going to start with you. What's making you happy this week, buddy?
We've talked about Tig Notaro before on this show. We talked about specifically her stand-up set called that has been released as Tig Notaro Live, where she came out on stage after a lot of crap had happened to her,
yes,
including
indeed.
being diagnosed with cancer, and just riffed on it, said, came out saying, hello, how is everybody? I have cancer. That took off. That became viral, whatever you want to call it. It became huge. She has a new stand-up special on HBO called Tig Notaro, Boyish Girl Interrupted, and it is her at the top of her game. Very dry, very deadpan. She does this thing with pauses. She takes these pauses, and she has such confidence that the audience stays with her. She is just in total control of the audience. There's also a Showtime special called Knock Knock, It's Tig Notaro, where she goes to fans' homes who invite her, and she performs for them. And finally, there is also on Netflix streaming a documentary simply called Tig, which talks about that whole period of time when all the crap was happening. We see her in the hospital. We see her dealing with all kinds of stuff. And what happened after this huge stand-up set happened, where she's trying to figure out what now? I'm kind of associated with this. What's the next step? And as she's going through all this, she is falling in a very complicated kind of love. All these things together show you the whole person, or at least the illusion of the whole person, mm-hmm. in a legitimately moving way. So that's Tig Notaro, Boyish Girl Interrupted, Knock Knock, It's Tig Notaro, and Tig, the documentary on Netflix streaming.
I'm glad you recommended those. All right, Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, something that I originally brought to the stuff we didn't get around to talking about,
yes.
was a TV show called Mr. Robot,
yes.
on the USA Network. And we all started talking about it and got so animated,
yeah.
realized simultaneously that all three of us love it.
Yes.
Spoiler, because we're going to talk about it next week.
Yes, we are.
We're going to do a full segment on how much we're enjoying this show. And my dear friend and former AV Club colleague, Tasha Robinson,
yeah.
Writing for the... That in and of itself makes me happy.
Yes.
Tasha's been doing a bunch of great writing on our website about
right.
Worldcon and the Hugo Awards and some of the controversy swirling around that. Did a wonderful kind of distillation of
yeah.
what that controversy is that made me understand it completely. Our pal Petra Mayer has been doing pieces on the radio about
mm-hmm.
this issue as well. Just wonderful, comprehensive coverage. Just a couple of music recommendations as summer gives way to fall.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of terrific fall records. I've been thinking, like, why do I love these, like, slow, dreamy records so much? And I realized it's because I am a gigantic ball of nerves.
Nice.
And these are calming records. One is by a band that had always been kind of, like but not love for me,
mm-hmm.
called Beach House. And their records had always felt a little remote to me. This record does not feel remote to me. It's got burrowed deep under my skin. The album is called Depression Cherry, which is kind of a perfect name for the sound. It's gloomy and shiny at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's actually hear a little bit of a song called Sparks.
Yeah.
very beautiful, unbelievably consistent in tone, and that sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it really works for this record. The other is a singer-songwriter from Louisville named Joan Shelley, whose record comes out next week. It's called Over and Even. It hits you right in that like Joni Mitchell spot.
Sure.
It's so beautiful. The first single is out. It's called Stay on My Shore. It's a duet between Joan Shelley and Will Oldham, Bonnie Prince Billy. It's balm on my nerves. It takes each individual nerve ending and sands it down. That's too rough. It polishes it.
Wonderful.
The Beach House record is out now. The Joan Shelley record comes out September 4th, but is streaming at NPR Music now. And finally, if you're going to be in Washington, D.C. on September 16th, NPR is having a launch party for our new Hidden Brain podcast. You will be hearing a lot more about Hidden Brain in the weeks and months to come. It's going to be fantastic. NPR is doing a whole day of events surrounding the launch. There will be a meet and greet with some of your favorite podcast personalities. I can say that I will be one of them. Guy Raz will be there. Lulu and Elise from our rival podcast, Invisibilia, will be in attendance. If you go to npr.org/PCHH or facebook.com/PCHH, we will throw up a link for you to apply to attend this very special event.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I have a few things this week. I will start with, I am going to play the Glen this week. I'm going to recommend a podcast. You know how we like to recommend a podcast.
We do.
Sometimes we like to recommend a music podcast. Mm-hmm. I found a new one this week. It is called Switched on Pop, and I think it is one that either one or both of you might like. There are a couple shows like this, but this is another one where they kind of like take a song and try to kind of take it apart.
Sure.
And this one, they specifically are very into pop. So, for example, there's a really good episode about the Carly Rae Jepsen, I really, 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 et cetera. Mostly around the idea of whether it is or isn't as good as Call Me Maybe and why.
Ah. Right?
And they sort of go into how those songs are similar in structural ways that I never would have noticed because that's not my specialty at all. There's a really good one about Take Me to Church, which basically does the same thing and explains why the changing, for example, the changing back and forth between major and minor chords is important thematically to what's happening in the song, to the uncertainty about faith in the song. Mm-hmm. It's very, very interesting. Again, it's called Switched on Pop. I like that one. So there's that. And then also my final thing is a Tumblr called meninhenleys.tumblr.com. Mm-hmm. Just thank me later.
Oh, yes.
Men in Henleys.
I thank you now.
.tumblr.com.
I'm
not going to say anything else about it, mm-hmm. except it's Men in Henleys. That's all it is. meninhenleys.tumblr.com. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all three of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Steven at IDislikeSteven. And you can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow our extremely patient producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Thanks to both of you guys for being here for this very special experiment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here with four people in these chairs next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. The Ask Me Another podcast is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. And on the latest episode, Sir Patrick Stewart talks about living in Brooklyn and becoming a knight. Then he recites well-known song lyrics with the gravitas of a West End performance. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.